Jeff Sobel is a freelance writer who is the co-author of the book The Color of Your Dreams, The Beatles' Psychedelic Music, and he's speaking to us from Oakland, California. Hi, Jeff.
How's it going?
Good, good. Thanks for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
So how old were you in 1966 when Revolver came out?
I was the ripe old age of 3.
Okay. So I'm talking to a lot of folks who fall into this category who weren't really of a conscious music consuming age when Revolver came out. So tell me a little bit about how you came to an appreciation of Revolver.
Well, I came to it in part through my co-author, Stuart Maedow, who he really started turning me on to a lot of different music through high school and into early college years. And then a little bit later, we started getting into this project, and I have to give him credit for this because the project was much of his idea.
So you guys went to school together, Jeff?
We went to high school together.
Okay.
Even though, actually, we didn't know each other too much in high school, but we forged a very strong friendship right after high school.
So can you paint a picture of perhaps Stuart introducing you to Revolver? Was it something like that, like you got to hear this?
I think it was more a case of he started introducing me to a lot of different things, and he's a huge Beatles fan, and I've actually been a Beatles fan for a long time. So I was conscious of probably some of the more, what would be considered the poppier songs off of Revolver, like Good Day Sunshine and those types. But he really started turning me on to some of the psychedelic songs more so.
I see. So when you guys came up on this project again, you revisited the album in a serious way. Is that what you told me?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of qualifying that. We would go through each of the songs, in particular the psychedelic songs, and really kind of deconstruct them and look at their instrumentation, their influences, how they came together, and maybe even, you know, delving into what they were thinking at the time and what other influences might have gone into the song.
Well, I'm going to ask you about some of the songs, but let me just ask you, what is it that you would like to say about this album? I mean, what do you think about when you think about Revolver in terms of, you know, the music that you've listened to and where your appreciation for it falls?
Boy, there's several areas I can really talk to. First of all, it's simply a groundbreaking album, and you can argue whether or not it's the Beatles' greatest album. I know a lot of people say no, it's Sgt. Pepper. But in terms of being influential and being in its importance, I think it's probably more important than Sgt. Pepper because it really started creating a bridge between what they were doing in, say, 1964 and 1965, which was obviously more to the pop side, and really just getting more serious, and you can start to feel some of the wear and tear that they've been going through by being in the public eye for probably 3 or 4 years at that point, and just having all these expectations and all this weight upon them, and you start to feel that in some of the tone of the music and the fact that they're starting to dabble more heavily into drugs, and also starting to feel some of the influences with the Tibetan and Indian mysticism as well.
Well, take those one at a time then.
Okay.
Give me an example of how you feel like the music reflects something about the weight of the pressure of touring or whatever you said.
Well, I think let's take I'm Only Sleeping, for instance, where you see Lennon saying, hey, I think it's okay to just, you know, hang out in bed and not worry about, you know, everyone is running around and they have all these stresses and all these pressures. And I think, you know, I think it's time I just kind of chilled out and stayed in bed. And that type of influence and you could actually start to see some of it even on Rubber Soul before that, where the tone starts to get a little bit more somber in places and those types of things.
Okay, and then the other influences that you were or trends that you were talking about that you thought started reflecting in the music.
Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about if you look at some of the spiritual aspect, I think I would say Harrison was probably the first to really go there. And if you look at a song like Love You Too, where it starts bringing a lot of Indian musical influences and really trying to take the form of an Indian raga even. But John Lennon as well was influenced by the Tibetan Book of the Dead, for some of his work too.
Let me ask you about Love You Too a little bit more. Could you expand a little bit on that piece of music and perhaps lyrically what is intriguing about it?
Well, I think you can see Harrison's definitely starting to look more inward and trying to find some spirituality. And I think for the most part, the group was kind of away from religion for quite a number of years. I mean, McCartney, quite early in his life, I think in his early teens, had kind of turned away from religion when his, I believe it was his mother died, and he, you know, was looking for some type of explanation, and he felt like the church had failed him. And, you know, obviously the comments, and I think it was 1965, about the Beatles being, you know, bigger than Jesus in a lot of people's minds, showed some of that as well. So I think now with you know, kind of the material aspect of their careers having hit such high points, they started looking more inwardly and looking for a little bit more spiritual escape, or in the case of Lennon, more so narcotic escape.
Yeah, I've heard people say that this album shows the Beatles looking inward and outward, but not so much at the boy-girl relationship. Will you buy that?
Yeah, I would buy that. I don't think you see too many things about relationships, at least not necessarily positively. I mean, a song like For No One is kind of a sad kind of song that way. I mean, if you look at that as a relationship song, it's certainly not a pleasant one in that respect. The tone's much quieter.
Yeah. Maybe Here, There, and Everywhere, the lone exception.
Yeah, and Got to Get You Into My Life, perhaps.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say that's pretty accurate.
Well, let's pick some of these songs. What are some... I'll let you... you know, pick a song to talk about, and you know, what I'm looking for is, you know, what moves you about the music. You know, I'm looking for kind of the energy that, not so much analytical, although, you know, you can certainly go there as you talk about it, but you know, what impresses you, what knocks you out, what moves you in some of these tracks. And I'll just let you take a pick and maybe ask you a follow-up question.
Boy, that's a hard one. Just looking at, you know, looking at some of the songs that we're talking about, there are so many of them to really get into.
Would you prefer that I mention a track?
Sure, go for it.
Okay, well, Rain was the flip side of the single that was recorded right about this time, actually, a couple weeks after they started work on the album, and it was released early.
Right,
and some have called it the first great psychedelic song. What's your take on listening to Rain?
I would think that I would actually tend to agree with you on that, and it really, that song probably, and we covered as the first psychedelic song in our book.
Let me interrupt because I forgot to mention something. Since I probably won't be using a lot of my questions in this, when I ask you a question, kind of turn it around and, you know, fill in the blank, like, and mention the song title instead of saying, you know, it is, you know, say Rain is. Okay.
Okay, that's no problem. Okay, Rain definitely, and we cover Rain pretty to some extent in our book, and that is the first one that we cover as kind of kicking off the psychedelic era for the Beatles. And you start to see some of the treatments of vocals and the music. The tone of the music is a little bit dreamier, and the bass line is fantastic. But, I mean, just on kind of an emotional level, the song, especially being here in the Bay Area and it being wintertime, and as we were discussing a little bit before, there's been plenty of rain here, and, you know, the tone of the song is it's just water. It's not anything to really get down about. There are people who will complain about the sun when it's shining, there'll people who complain about the rain when it's shining, and really it's just a kind of a call to not really think about it that hard and just kind of enjoy it for what it is. And in that respect, it's a really beautiful song.
And then there's, I think, the first example of backwards vocals, or one of the first. I don't know. Certainly when the Beatles do it, everybody notices. But that must have been a bit surprising when it first came out.
Yeah, the backwards vocals, and really the entire Revolver album. I mean, the backwards vocals on Rain, there's backwards guitars in several tracks as well. And if you look at the album as a whole, it's kind of it has a certain dichotomy to it, because there are some of the poppy elements to it, and you can look at a song like, Yellow Submarine's pretty poppy, Good Day Sunshine, those types of things. But you start to see these different influences with experimentation with sounds, experimentations with instruments, and you also start to see the growing role of George Martin, not just as a producer, but as an arranger and composer, and really kind of the unspoken fifth member of this group. And especially a song like Eleanor Rigby has, you know, some tremendous orchestral arrangements on it. And even his influence, I think, on For No One using a French horn. I mean, these are things that hadn't been done before. And it was kind of a portent to what was coming up in the next, you know, with Sgt. Pepper and with probably with Magical Mystery Tour as well.
And then you mentioned influences, and I'm curious, do you mean that that they are bringing in other influences that they've experienced into the music? Is that how you're using the word there?
Yeah, I think that's that. As far as influences go, they're bringing in, well, obviously the most blatant is with Harrison on Love You Too and bringing in the Indian instrumentation. But even some of the lyrics, and one of the things that we note is that John Lennon paid quite a bit of attention to Bob Dylan and Bob Dylan's lyrical presentation. So he had been much more of a music person before he really started listening to Dylan and his lyrics, not just what they said, but how they sounded. And you can see that starting to come in as well.
Can you give an example? Like,
what would be a good example? I think I'm Only Sleeping has a bit of it.
I'm thinking she said maybe.
She said, and I mean the opening line of that, you know, it's saying I know what it's like to be dead. I mean, that's a very impactful line. You know, you're making me feel like I've never been born, and just his improvement in lyric writing starts to show in this album especially.
Yeah, and there's that segment in She Said where, I guess it's the bridge or something, she said, let's see, wait a minute now. She said, you don't know, I have to look it up now. Got all these songs bouncing around my head.
She said, you don't understand.
She said, you don't understand what I said. I said, no, you're wrong. You're when wrong. I was a boy, you know.
Everything was fine.
Yeah.
Everything was right. Yeah, so, but this song in particular, getting back to influences, also came out pretty directly out of a somewhat bad LSD trip. And it's also an example of how Lennon could take something like this bad experience and turn it into something pretty brilliant, lyrically, and I don't know, maybe it's a way for him to kind of deal with the bad experience too.
Mm-hmm. When you think about this album as being a landmark for psychedelic music or pop music, mm-hmm. in general, people tend to want to know, okay, well, how did it start changing the scenery? Like, how did who followed this lead? Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think I can talk a little bit toward how this album changed, kind of what, or ushered in, I guess, the psychedelic period. And I think what,
okay, so start a sentence with, like, you know, so Revolver.
So I would say that Revolver could be argued as ushering in the psychedelic period in music, both in the U.S. and really around the world. But I think it's also important to point out that at that time there were other lesser-known groups that were writing music that would easily be classified as psychedelic. The difference is you had the biggest mouthpiece, for lack of a better word, for the music industry across the world suddenly saying, hey, this is really cool, let's do it, and let's do it our way. And at that point, it's a lot like, you know, when another band comes along, even now, and they hit upon something stylistically that's different or hasn't been heard, there's all this rush to start finding other groups that are doing those types of things. And if it's, you know, someone like the Strawberry Alarm Clock or the Chocolate Watch Band, those types of things, then all of a sudden there's a forum for bands like that. And, you know, obviously here in San Francisco, coming up the following year or two, it opened up a much greater audience for psychedelia.
So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned I'm only sleeping a couple times. There's more backwards content in this one, guitar licks this time.
Yes.
What's interesting about the backwards guitar licks in I'm Only Sleeping?
Well, there are a couple things that are interesting about the backward guitar licks in I'm Only Sleeping. First, that they're in I'm Only Sleeping. I mean, the fact that they're being used alone is I guess, considered pretty progressive for such a big group to be doing. I mean, it's a diversion from what they'd been doing the previous couple years, and they're starting to take some risks and knowing that they're able to take the risks. And just the sound of it is unusual and new.
Can you imagine it being difficult in the recording studio? Because it wasn't really randomly done. Do you know much
about...
No, not
at all.
Yeah, can you talk about how carefully it appears to mesh with the song itself?
Yeah, I think as far as the backward guitars go on I'm Only Sleeping, and some of these comments are applicable for a number of the songs, not just that, but and I want to get to Tomorrow Never Knows at some point, because that's just, to me, is a stunning composition. But it is a meticulous process given the technology of 1966, where I think what they had to work with were four-track machines, and I don't even know if they'd gotten to 8-track at that point. And then it was just pure experimentation with sounds. So it's recording something, running it through some type of processor, and just doing whatever you could to distort it, given, you know, it's like the MacGyver approach of producing. It's like, okay, we have a paperclip, a rubber band, and a pencil, and we're going to make a song. So it was a lot of experimentation, and again, getting back to George Martin's role and also his production staff, they did some phenomenal things with very limited technology, especially when you look at, you know, unlimited numbers of tracks that you can record on now and practically unlimited amounts of effects that you can apply to those tracks.
Okay, so Tomorrow Never Knows is really a psychedelic playground.
That's a good way of putting that, yeah.
What do you think of when you assess this track?
Boy, that's... Tomorrow Never Knows, I think, as a track is just mind-blowing, and it's pivotal in any number of ways and probably well ahead of its time in terms of just being thrust upon the listening audience. And if something like I'm Only Sleeping was somewhat mind-blowing, then Tomorrow Never Knows probably just completely stunned people and just shocked people. Calling it a playground of sound is a very applicable way of putting it. It's all these, I mean, just the instrumentation and the effects of the instrumentation and Lennon's vocals are pretty stunning, but when you start to throw in all these sound effects that were created in the studio and how far ahead of their time they were, and, you know, you can look at a group like Prodigy still ripping that song off 35 years later. I mean, that to me is a mark of what a tremendous composition it really is. But also and whether it was intentional or not, as being placed as the final cut on side two of the album also set it up as kind of a harbinger of what was to come on Sgt. Pepper as well. And I think that's sometimes overlooked in its importance.
I'll talk about it lyrically too. I mean, when you think about psychedelic lyrics,
Well, just the opening lyrics of the song, "Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream," that's a tremendous invitation just to really immerse yourself in the song. And it gets a little bit back to what we talked about earlier with kind of Lennon's experimenting with the sound of the lyrics, not just what they're saying. And it's just the way that it invites a listener into the song is brilliant.
Are there particular moments in the song that you want to pull out and call to listeners' attention?
Boy, there are so many. I think even just the opening of the song with the drums and the bass and all these just kind of flying, screeching sound effects You know, if you hadn't been prepared for it by the rest of the album, then I think that's probably the point of greatest impact of the song. And then to have that somewhat tempered a little bit by the lyrics to kind of turn off and just let yourself go with the flow of the song, I think it's almost a moderating influence on the opening instrumentation.
What else? Have you listened to the Take One version of this song that was issued on the anthology?
I'm not sure I have,
okay.
Actually.
All right. I won't go there then.
Okay.
All right. Anything else before leaving Tomorrow Never Knows that you were itching to say?
Let me look at a note here or two. Well, I think it's kind of interesting to note about the song, and maybe this was something speaking toward the, I don't know, the ego or the status that the Beatles had gotten at that point. But initially, Lennon wanted to try and get 1,000 Tibetan monks to chant on this song. And, you know, it's not a care who you are. It's just, you know, something you just can't pull off. So he had to settle for what George Martin, and I'm using settle facetiously, for what George Martin and his crew came up with for sound effects in the studio.
What other tracks do you want to pull out and talk about here? I think we mentioned She Said a little bit, but that certainly has a psychedelic feel for sure. We did talk about I'm Only Sleeping. I'm kind of jumping around to the ones that sort of probably suited your theme a little bit better. But
yeah, and we went a little bit into talking about Taxman and Eleanor Rigby as well, and not that they were considered pure psychedelic songs or even partially psychedelic songs, but if you look at the tone of them, Eleanor Rigby in particular, it's a very dark, kind of somber song. And George Martin's arrangement of the strings on that song was really fit the tone and set the tone for that composition. And then Taxman starts to show a little bit more of kind of the aggressive tone, or I don't know, I guess cynical is a good way to put it, for Harrison and you know, his writing checks to the government for taxes. But that kind of cynicism and somber tone, it's a carry through from what you started to see again on Rubber Soul, and it still permeates a lot of this out of Revolver as well.
I think the most psychedelic moment on Taxman is the lead guitar solo, which I think is a McCartney solo.
Yeah, it's pretty strong, but I love the bass line throughout the song is fantastic, and that's been covered numerous times, I think, since.
Through Taxman?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'd read that in the recording notes that weren't they doing something to bring the bass out more in recordings through this period?
Yeah, I think they were pushing, not necessarily the level, but the prominence of the bass. And McCartney is a fantastic bass player, without question. And his playing and his virtuosity really raised the prominence of that instrument for a lot of other groups to come afterward as well. It wasn't so much of a background rhythm piece as much as it could be, more in the foreground as part of a composition and arrangement.
Right. Or even lead bass.
Absolutely.
Something that we started hearing from people like Jack Bruce and stuff. I would gather that Yellow Submarine fit into your analysis a little bit. Did you guys deconstruct that as something of a psychedelic composition?
We didn't go into it too far. We really didn't go into Yellow Submarine too far. But I guess if you look at kind of the journey and this the trip that the submarine takes and the Beatles take on the submarine, I you could probably see the influence of probably some LSD within that, and you know, just heading down that path. And it's a little more whimsical and a little bit lighter tone. But you can definitely see it going down that path, yes.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other personal favorites on the album that you want to say something about that we haven't talked about, even if they don't fit into the psychedelic milieu?
It's hard to not find a personal favorite on on this album. I mean, Revolver, just the up and down is strong. I guess if I had a least favorite song, it would probably be Dr. Robert. But that also gets back to showing, you know, the influence of Narcotics on Lennon in particular, because if I'm correct, Dr. Robert was actually a real person, and he was kind of a supplier for a lot of people, not just in the Beatles.
Yeah, that's the story, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, Good Day Sunshine is just, it's just a really nice piece. I really like For No One, just because of the tone. I think the French horn in particular is an instrument I like hearing, and it's very well used in this composition, too.
Let me ask you to back up to Good Day Sunshine, because I haven't had a lot of comments about it. What appeals to you about that track?
Well, Good Day Sunshine has a number of appealing things. I think just the way it flows, it's kind of a nice frolicking kind of song. And me loving sunshine is, you know, as much as anyone, or more so than a lot of people. I mean, that aspect of it, especially after dealing with a week of torrential rain, to be able to go out and, you know, feel the sun on your face, it's just it's a pretty uplifting feeling, and that I think that song kind of captures that essence.
And then the harmonies that lead that song off are pretty attention-grabbing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the harmonies the start of Good Day Sunshine are, well, I mean, they're just typical Beatles harmonies. They've been doing it for, you know, what, 3-4 years at that point, and they'd done it so many times that they were just perfect at it. And the harmonies on this album, on pretty much every album that they ever did, were far and above better than just about everyone else, you know, you've ever heard. I mean, Crosby, Stills, and Nash could do it. A group called Jellyfish, I don't know if you're familiar with them, occasionally could pull it off like that. But to be that consistent for that long is just pretty stunning. And it shows the closeness and the tightness of the four guys.
So this album is often rated as the Beatles' top collection. You mentioned that it sort of seems to be neck and neck with Sgt. Pepper. And, of course, a lot of all-time rock lists have also elevated this to the top spot. Why does it get so much attention?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, the compositions that make up Revolver, just from top to bottom, the songs on Revolver are excellent. I mean, every one of these is excellent. I think a majority of the compositions on Sgt. Pepper are stronger, and I guess some of that should be qualified as more in the case of as more works of what we considered psychedelic art. Sgt. Pepper's compositions are stronger, but that's not really what Revolver was about as a whole. But I think it starts to elevate, you know, into many people's top 10 simply because of its importance in music history and its influence. And again, kind of ushering in the psychedelic era to the mainstream, is that the importance of that, you know, of Revolver can't really be emphasized enough. And that's probably why you're starting to see more and more people give it the respect it deserves as a seminal piece of music.
And does it do that because it gave everybody permission to not only use these kind of sounds, but just to experiment in general, and also to just start to work on studio craft, I guess you would say?
Yeah, I think to say Revolver gave permission to all these other groups and even, you know, radio stations, record companies to start opening up to this form of music and giving it the forum it really deserved is a very accurate statement. And it did make it okay for a record label to say, okay, we're gonna take a chance on this group because they're experimenting and they're doing this really progressive, what for them is very progressive music. And I think it did challenge producers, technicians in the studio to try and come up with things that were farther out there, more imaginative, if that's possible, and really elevate the quality of music and production at that time period.
Jeff, is there anything else that you want to add or retake or restate? Because I think I'm kind of out of questions for you.
Okay. I don't know. I think just probably the thing I would close with is just that if our listeners haven't really delved into Revolver that far, it begs to be taken back out and put on, whether you have a turntable or a CD player, and really just listen to it. And one of the things that I started getting a greater appreciation for Revolver during the process of writing the book with Stuart was the way we approached it, and with Stuart kind of feeding me notes and deconstructing the songs and putting in his comments, it forced me to sit down and really listen to the music and start pulling out individual instruments and even, you know, bass lines and guitar riffs and effects, and listening to music in a completely different way. And I think this may be the first album where, if you want to sit down and listen to even, you know, any of its tracks, but in particular the psychedelic songs, and really just pick them apart and listen for sounds and listen for instruments, you're probably rewarded as much as any album you're going to listen to for your efforts.
Jeff Sobel is the co-author of the book The Color of Your Dreams, The Beatles' Psychedelic Music, and he joined us from Oakland, California. Thanks for talking with us, Jeff.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate it.
Okay, good show. I appreciate I appreciate all the good thought that came out of that. And
well, hopefully some of it made sense.
Yeah, well, I am, you know how these things work probably, is that talk for 25 minutes with a bunch of people, and always their best stuff comes to the fore, so.
Yeah. I hope so. Yeah. Hopefully there's some stuff on there you can use, and it's not going to all end up on the cutting room floor, as it were.
Yeah, and I did talk with Stuart today.
Oh, you did? How's he doing? I haven't talked with him in a bit.
Good.
I told him I actually just got his new phone number yesterday or today. I need to give him a call just to see how he's doing. Yeah, Oh, good. Yeah, we have a pretty interesting. I mean, we were really, really close back in like college time, and then early time after that, and then I moved to Kansas City. But we had one of those friendships where we could, you know, talk every 6 months, and it was just picking up right where we left off. And the fact that he could send cassettes and we would have almost identical thoughts, like, you know, at the same time when I was listening to his notes, really made working on this book so much easier. Yeah. Yeah, that was a pleasure, I gotta say. Okay. Mm-hmm. That'd be awesome. I hope so. It's Crofton Avenue, if it's on there. It's 524 Crofton Avenue. C-R-O-F as in Frank, T-O-N. 94610. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's it. Mm-hmm. Oh, very cool. Oh, it was my pleasure, and thanks for the inquiry. I'm happy to do it. Okay, that sounds good. Thank you. Bye. He is going to call you in about 5 minutes.
Okay.
How'd that sound to you?
That sounded great. I'm...